Listener Production.
G'day, it's Cliff, and thank you for being with us. There is a major event, not only for Margaret River and the Southwest, but for the state and I think for the country. Strings Attached Festival is coming back again. It's going to be October 7 to 9. There will be masterclasses, some special guests as well, some unique performances. As far as I know, a lot of it has sold out, but I do have one of the special guests. If you think about the history of the electric guitar, there is one name that is mentioned again and again and again as a major influence. We will talk about some of that history with the Shadows, movies, even Thunderbirds, and now Gypsy Jazz. Hank Marvin, hello and welcome. How are you?
Hi, Cliff. I'm doing great for an old fella, thank you.
That's
it's great.
Good indeed.
I'm wondering, when you called, I thought, wow, I haven't heard from Cliff in a few months. Here he is again.
Shall I
and it was not the other Cliff. It was the real Cliff. You.
I'll tell the story again. I just told Hank this off air. Cliff Richard played a couple of years ago at Sandalford Winery at Swan Valley, and I was there, and one of the special guests for that night was Hank Marvin. He was going to be playing his red Stratocaster guitar, doing a couple of songs. Before the show, for some reason, I walked away from the stage. I don't know why, probably going to the bar. And I saw Hank Marvin in front of me, and I thought, am I going to say hello? Yes, I will. Oh, no, I won't. Oh, yes, I will. Oh, no, yes, I will. So I put my hand out. I said, oh, hello, Hank. It's nice to meet you. My name's Cliff. And Mr. Marvin said, you even look like him. And I thought, I'll take that. How often do you talk, by the way?
Not that frequently. You know, we live in different parts of the world, and now and again we contact one another, usually by email. Rather than on the telephone. Now and again, Cliff has actually called about something specific, you know, which he wanted to discuss in person as against with an email. Mm. But, you know, when we do contact each other, it's like we've never left off because we've had such a long association and friendship that you know what it's like in those situations. You just pick it up so easily, so quickly, and you're back to where you were maybe 6 months ago or whatever, you know.
I mentioned some of the influences. Eric Clapton has cited you as an influence. People like Steve Vai, Mark Knopfler, what did he ever do? Various others. You've been called an inventor, an originator, the single note guitarist, the first Stratocaster in England. Are you aware of the influence that you've had on musicians, and how does that feel?
Well, originally, no. I mean, we knew obviously that the Shadows were attracting copyists, if you like, Cliff, because you know, go show. You see, obviously, like a bunch of guys, you look out into an audience who are all dressed the same, one wearing glasses like me, trying to look like us, and things like this. But I didn't realize the influence we'd had until much later, probably in the 70s, traveling around here and there. We'd sometimes at airports bump into other bands or musicians. And there were quite a lot of younger guys coming up who were in what was then new sort of heavy metal type bands, you know. Mm. And some of the guitarists who became famous came up and just, oh, man, great to meet you. You know, you're the reason I'm playing guitar. I think the idea was when they heard me play, they thought, I can do better than that. You know, that was the way it was.
Yeah. They couldn't, but they could think that if they wanted to. But, I mean, even people like Clapton, Brian May mentions one of the songs, Shadoogie, on their first thing. And, you know, he said he kind of stole some of your stuff. That is history, you know, music history. If you think about it, you had the first Stratocaster in England. Man, that is huge. I know Bruce Welch has got it now. Maybe he'll give it back one day. But that really is, it's a sense of history.
Yeah. Well, yes, it is. It is. And I think it means perhaps more to those outside, you know, other musicians, some of the ones you mentioned and others who were big Shads fans. I remember Pete Townsend, for example, from Who, telling me that he had, when he and his mates started playing, they were mad Shads fans, and they used to try to be the first to get the latest release so they could learn it before anyone else. Mm. And so, you know, it has had the influence, and I think it means more. It's like, obviously, I had my influences, and I'm sure it means more to me than it does to the individuals who influence me. But it's flattering when people say that, obviously, Cliff. It's flattering, and it makes you feel good because you think, well, you know, some of these guys, if that was the reason they picked up a guitar and they've gone on to be, really innovators themselves, like Eric, I mean, Brian May, to me, they're all guys with a specific style that you recognize, Jeff Beck, others, we can go on and on. But the point is, they've made such a wonderful contribution to music themselves, but they have to have a something that kicked them off, just as I did. And that's it's a nice feeling to think, well, at least, mind you, if it hadn't been me, it'd be someone else, so who knows?
1958. How on earth did you persuade your folks to let you go to London at the age of 16 to pursue music? Surely there would have been people saying, "Oh no, no, Brian, get a proper job, son."
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? No, I persuaded my parents that the only way we could possibly get into the music industry properly, I mean, we were playing around Newcastle, my hometown, with a skiffle group and doing quite a bit of work in what were known as working men's clubs and that sort of stuff, And we were actually still at school, but Bruce and I left prematurely to go to London, and I was surprisingly, it was easy to persuade them I needed to do that. I think, quite honestly, Cliff, they thought that within a few months or a year at the most, I'd be back with my tail between my legs. But they recognized it was something that we really needed to do. We did it, and fortunately, things turned out well for us. It could have been a disaster, obviously, but it turned out well.
And was there a point when you said, and then your folks said, "Yeah, I think this is going to be all right. It'll work out okay."
Yeah, I think once we started working regularly with Cliff from, well, October 1958, when we did the first tour with him, and we were then doing it regularly. We were sort of paid a retainer as the then the Drifters, and of course, coming back to Newcastle and playing with Cliff in front of screaming teenagers, it impressed everybody. It's like the prodigal son's return. But, yeah, and then obviously, by 1960, we had our own success with Apache, and then the career took off at an alarming rate, and we became a sort of an institution. So I think, the fact that we were working and were coming back successfully was the point from our parents that thought, oh, wow, they're okay now. They're doing the right thing. They're actually working and paying their own rent.
You're not coming home now, son. Out there. What are your memories of those rehearsals, the first rehearsals in the early stages with Cliff Richards at his home in Hertfordshire? Was there something where you said, "Oh, this is good"?
Yeah, when he made a cup of tea.
White and one.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Cliff, it was quite interesting. We first met Cliff in Old Compton Street in Soho. He was being fitted for this brilliant, marvelous pink jacket he wore on the first tour. It was real rock and roll stuff. And we met him there for the first time, and we got on a Green Line bus, which were the buses that went out of places like Hertfordshire and Surrey and all those. And we went to his parents' house, which was a council house in a small town called Cheshunt, and we rehearsed in the front room. So it would just be the four of us plus Cliff, the four-piece band plus Cliff. And there are still some photographs around of us in that same room a few weeks later doing more rehearsals. And as soon as we started to rehearse, we heard him sing live. There was a quality to, I mean, he improved over the years, obviously, but there was a quality to his voice, and there was something about him, the way, we only did five or six numbers in the show, but for example, we did a whole lot of shaking, and he did the bit where you take the music very low, and he got down on the floor and did all the stuff, and he was doing it all, and we thought, wow, this guy's got something. And I'll tell you what, the first night when we hit that stage, the first night of the tour, we were actually supporting the Kaelin Twins, who were the number one hit at the time.
Yes.
And it was like as soon as the compere came on and mentioned Cliff's name, it went bananas. And we thought, what? I mean, it was just the screaming was terrifying almost. And we couldn't hear ourselves play or sing. It was nonstop screaming. And we realized straight away, wow, This kid is going to be big.
And how about you with the spotlight? Were you looking to just be a really good guitarist, or did you want to be a star?
Well, I wanted to be a better guitarist, let's put it that way, because I was being looked upon at the time by quite a few people as a young guitarist who had something. I mean, I wasn't great or anything, but I think they recognized I had something. But also, where Bruce and I, you know, we used to sing a lot of harmonies, and we started singing harmonies behind Cliff. And in fact, the interesting thing is that Cliff got us our first recording contract. He loved the way we sang the harmonies, and he went to Norrie Paramore, the record producer who was doing Cliff's records, to persuade him to give us an audition, which he did, and he signed us up. And funny enough, not as instrumentalists, but as an instrumental vocal group. And that's how we go. So that was it. So, I mean, we didn't think so much of a stardom, but what we did recognize, Cliff, was that if you were successful, you could earn a decent living, let's put it that way. You know, we didn't think in terms of rich and famous. It didn't go that far at that point. And that's all we thought about, you know, doing something we loved doing and earning money for doing it, making a living. That's as far as it went in our minds, I think.
The movies were amazing. I've had a look again at some of the movies, Summer Holiday and various others, and you guys are there. There's a lovely lovely actor, Melvin Hayes, who went on to be in It Ain't Half Hot, Mum. Very funny, very, very clever actor indeed. But then they turned you into a marionette for the Thunderbirds. I read this and thought, come on, somebody's taken the mickey out of me. But then I found it. You were in the Thunderbirds.
Yeah, they approached our management. Said, look, we'd love to have Cliff in the Shadows in a scene from this Thunderbirds movie, the first Thunderbird movie they were doing. And obviously that was all negotiated, discussed, and we had to go to all these sessions where they took various photographs, looked at us, made these marionettes, and we wrote some music for the movie. And it's quite a thrill, because Thunderbirds were enormous at the time, and particularly with children, you know, they thought this was the best thing since sliced bread, that their parents were going to be in Thunderbirds. Didn't care anything about us as musicians, but hey, you're in Thunderbirds, you must be doing something.
Who cares about the Strat? Who cares about the finger-picking style? You were in Thunderbirds. Yes, you can have kudos there.
That's
you were
right.
At the Swinging Star Club. And I read some other stuff too, Hank, here, that you played all over the world, African townships, riots in Germany, so many people in the streets, they tried to turn the limo over. Is it true that in South Africa they threw tear gas canisters on stage to try and get rid of the audience?
Well, that did happen, in fact, but it wasn't South Africa. It was actually in Morocco.
Good Lord.
We played in a big open air sort of stadium, which was used as a bull ring, among other things. And the first part of the show turned out to be a talent competition, and it was hysterical. The audience throwing stuff at the people trying to perform. It was honestly, it was like a black comedy. It's crazy. That one guy came on, he was singing in an operatic voice. He had his own pianist with him who wore dark glasses. He led him on, sat him at the piano. And apparently this blind man was playing the piano. This rather overweight guy was singing It's Now or Never in a very operatic voice. And he was being pelted with tomatoes and cabbages and all kinds of stuff. And it got so bad that eventually he ran off the stage, and the funny thing was, the pianist, who was purporting to be blind, whipped off his dark glasses, and he ran off, dodging in and out of the equipment. So he wasn't blind at all, just trying to get sympathy. Shock. And so we went on, and the crowd went nuts. They were all pushing on towards the stage, and some were trying to climb on the stage. And fun enough, I remember we were playing a Bill Haley song called Razzle Dazzle. I don't know if you remember that.
Everybody razzle dazzle. Yep.
Exactly. Amazing. We're playing the song. And I just before got to the guitar solo, and I looked down and I saw this canister roll along the stage towards me with smoke coming out of it. And I thought, wow, someone's put a bomb on stage. So I sort of did a Chuck Berry duck walk across the stage very rapidly. Then I'm saying, bomb, bomb, bomb. And because of the noise, people couldn't hear. They say, what, what? And then fortunately, a policeman jumped on the stage and he kicked it at the audience, and it turned out to be a tear gas bomb. They were trying just to disperse the audience. They were concerned that there would be, you know, some injuries caused to not just the audience, but to us on stage if they managed to get on stage. I don't think they weren't being hostile. They just wanted to get in on the act, you know, and that's the way people did what people did in those days.
Ain't showbiz grand. You are one of the special guests for Strings Attached, and there's a number of other people going to be there. Chris Chaney will be there. Also, Dom Mariani, who I'm sure used to be with the Stems a long, long time ago, ages ago. And also with Gypsy Jazz, Gary Taylor and Nuncio Mondia are going to be there. I want to talk about Gypsy Jazz in a moment. But when you go to something like this, is it predominantly guitarists who just come to sit at your feet, worship, and say, how the hell did you do that?
No, they just come along and say, well, actually, we could have done it a lot better.
They wouldn't dare.
No, the thing is, we don't do much of this sort of work, really, Cliff. We've done a few couple of tours over in the Eastern States and New Zealand, which were very successful and enjoyable. It's more of a hobby for me, really. But what we found, the audience is it's very varied. It's just like a normal audience, you know. You'll get men and women, couples, etc. And what surprised us was that a lot of responses we got were from fans of myself and the Shads who came along out of curiosity, and they loved it. I'm glad to say that was a real thrill for us, that they really enjoyed the music, because it wasn't Shadow stuff. Although we do a couple of, would you believe, Shadows pieces in the show. We've rearranged them for our second album.
Ah.
One is Nivram, which was on the very first Shad's album. The other one is Guitar Tango. And they're different arrangements, but the audience recognize them immediately and respond to them. So, no, it's not that sort of audience where it's just guitarists. I'm sure there will be some in, but it's just a normal audience, really.
You mentioned in a couple of interviews that I saw that at the time you could hardly get arrested in England, but there was a monster hit in Australia back in 1969-70. It was called Sasha. Listen to this. Again, it's that I'm not a musician, Hank, but it's that single note thing too. What are your memories of doing that song?
This was a bit of a weird one, because sadly is no longer with us. Jerry Lorden, who wrote some of our early hits like Apache, Wonderful Land, Atlantis, and a couple of other tracks which were great, that we did on EPs and albums, and he wrote a few other, you know, song hits. He and Roger Cook, who was part of the Cook and Greenaway writing, who wrote a lot of big hits in the 60s, they were writing a song for Sasha Distel.
Oh.
And they start this, and as it was developing, they thought, wow, this tune would make a great instrumental. So they did a demo and brought it to me. And I loved it, and you know, went ahead and sort of tried to work out how to present it musically, which we did. We worked the arrangement out and everything, and I used a nylon strung guitar on the verse and my Strat on the choruses. And then they called it Sasha because they felt that was the least they could do. As they're writing the song for him, you never got it.
Sorry, Sasha.
I used to do this on stage with my band when I was touring with my band in the 1900s and the 2000s, not the Shads, just when I had my own band. I had and it was great, because I used to use a guitar on what's called a daisy stand. It's a stand where you rest an acoustic guitar on, so you're not holding it. And then you could, you know, leave that and swing this the strap in my back, swing around, play the choruses, then back to the guitar. And it always went big with the audiences, even though it was never a big hit in the UK. Couldn't get the airplay then, because instrumentals were out of fashion in the late 60s, early 70s.
Tell me about now Gypsy Jazz. What was the genesis of that project?
Well, I first of all, I recorded an acoustic album at the request of a lot of fans, which was called Guitar Player. It was a huge album in the UK, with a band on, but I just played acoustic guitar. And at that point, I started listening to Django Reinhardt again. Django Reinhardt was a gypsy guitarist who, along with Stephan Grappelli, formed a band called the Quintet of the Hot Club of France. And they were playing swing jazz just with acoustic instruments, violin, guitars, and bass, no drum. And he became one of the most innovative guitarists of the 20th century. And a lot of other people, gypsies and non-gypsies, are keeping this music alive. And some of them, I want to tell you, Cliff, are phenomenal players. They really are. They start when they're about 2 years old. Just by the time they get to 10, they're frightening. But anyway, I started listening to him again and some of the more modern exponents of this music, and it quite inspired me. And a couple of the tracks, I used that kind of influence. Like we did a version of Petite Fleur, which is Sidney Bechet tune, beautiful tune, in that sort of style. Just and I used actually a gypsy jazz guitar on most of the tracks. But that's and it was around that time when I thought, hey, I'd love to try to learn some of this music and try to play it because it would be quite a challenge. And I got together with Gary Taylor. We started playing around a bit. Then I invited Nunzio Mondia, who's a wonderful pianist and accordion player and an arranger. I've used them on a lot of my albums. And just to sit in with us, have a bit of fun. And that's how it started. Then we were invited to a couple of charity gigs, which we did. And then other people heard us say, hey, you should be playing some jazz clubs. And we did that for a bit of fun now and again. And that's basically how it started.
That music, the Cuban Afro style music, has had a bit of a resurgence. Well, not recently, but in, 20 years ago, I think, was the first time that I saw the Gypsy Kings. And then you had the Buena Vista Social Club, which was just monstrous, and they toured as well. So it's getting it to a completely different audience. How different is the music to play?
Yeah, well, well, it's quite true. They obviously have a gypsy musical component in their music, and that's why one reason why it was called Gypsy Jazz is that Django Reinhardt brought his gypsy background and his musical influences into the sphere of jazz. A lot of, I mean, he was remarkable, and he used to bend strings, use octaves, had a wonderful finger vib, lots of techniques which modern guitarists use, particularly in the rock world and blues world. But it for me it was a challenge because it's quite a different form of music. First of all, it's played on an acoustic guitar, gypsy jazz guitar, which are slightly longer scale than a normal guitar. That's the length of the neck, between the bridge and the nut, and so it's a little harder to play. And I haven't got my whammy bar, Cliff. I shake that whammy bar and get woo-hoo-hoo weird sound. I can't do that on the so I have to, you play it differently, let's put it that way. Plus, there is improvisation, and you've got to swing.
What do you think is your greatest achievement in music? Is it survival? Is it the innovations that you brought to the guitar? Because I'm kind of getting the feeling that you, in a way, might consider I was just in the right place at the right time, and then bite off more than you can chew and chew like all holy hell. Is that it?
I think just staying alive is an achievement.
Especially in the music industry.
No, actually, I think, Cliff, that on reflection, I've been asked this kind of question. I think what my forte has been able to, well, first of all, I developed a sound purely by accident in the main, a sound and a technique and a style which fortunately appealed to a lot of people. I think my forte has been able to play a tune with a lot of expression and feel with pretty good phrasing, and that's it's a lot harder than it sounds. Let's put it that way. I never thought it was that difficult, but I've talked to quite a few guitar teachers who say they find one of the most difficult things is getting students to actually play a tune that sounds convincing, it's got feel and some expression in it. I always try to play Cliff as if I'm a voice. My guitar's a voice, and I try to make it, we know how a singer can be so expressive and get the emotion across. And I try to do that on the guitar. And I think that's probably my forte, if you like.
Plus, you were a Thunderbird. Well, in the Thunderbirds.
Hey, one shouldn't sniff at that.
No. I hope they gave you the marionette afterwards.
No, unfortunately, they did. I think they kept all those for their archives. What I did get, though, there was this in one of the scenes, there was an acoustic guitar thing hanging up from the ceiling, and this thing was about 15 feet long.
Oh, good Lord.
And they were going to just destroy it at the end of the filming, and I said, "Could I take that?" And they said, "Yeah, sure." So I had it picked up. Stupidly, though, I put it in my garden. This is back in the UK, and of course, it wasn't designed to be left out in the weather. I went away on tour, came back, and the thing was beginning to come apart. All the glue was coming apart. And I had to bin it, unfortunately. But it looked quite stunning. But it was hell to play at 15 feet long. Wow.
You're never going to be able to get your fingers around the neck. If you can go up and down that neck, I say kudos to you, sir. Hank Marvin is one of the special guests at the West Australian Guitar Festival, Strings Attached. Sir, it has been lovely to be able to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope that you have a beaut day today, and I'm sure that you're going to be a big hit at the Guitar Festival. Hank Marvin, thank you.
Thank you, Cliff. We're looking forward to going there and seeing some of those other great players and all the rest of the stuff you mentioned earlier. But thanks so much for the interview. Appreciate it.
A Listener Production.